First of all, thank you very much for having me and inviting me to be here. I do have long-standing relationships with Partick Trinity. I've been a flower girl in here twice and have helped out at various kids' clubs as well over the years. And I just really thank you for having me. And a more recent connection. While I was in Uganda, I was at the airport very late one night and meeting a friend, and a couple from Scotland came off the aeroplane, and of course I had to find out, like my mother, make connections. They were from Scotland, so there might be some connection. And indeed there was a connection. It was David Craig. And when I used to go to Crusaders, we used to pray for the Craigs when they were in Zaire. So to be able to be standing with them in Uganda, and then they actually came to visit me the next day. So even that link, all these years, comes back to Partick Trinity. So, also, it's my prayer tonight that when I'm speaking, it's not me. I don't want any focus on me. I want to be a voice for these children in Uganda. I want to be an ambassador for these children, and for you to hear God speaking to you tonight in whatever way. And I pray that all of us, our hearts will be open to what God has to say to us. I'm going to start off with reading from Isaiah 58. And it's from verse 6. I'll read from verse 6. And it's talking about true and false worship and true fasting. No, the kind of fasting I want calls you to free those who are wrongly imprisoned and to stop oppressing those who work for you. Treat them fairly and give them what they earn. I want you to share your food with the hungry and to welcome poor wanderers into your homes. Give clothes to those who need them, and do not hide from relatives who need your help. If you do these things, your salvation will come like the dawn. Yes, your healing will come quickly. Your godliness will lead you forward, and the glory of the Lord will protect you from behind. Then when you call, the Lord will answer. Yes, I am here, he will quickly reply. Stop oppressing the helpless, and stop making false accusations and spreading vicious rumors. Feed the hungry and help those in trouble. Then your light will shine out from the darkness, and the darkness around you will be as bright as day. The Lord will guide you continually, watering your life when you are dry and keeping you healthy too. You will be like a well-watered garden, like an ever-flowing spring. Your children will rebuild the deserted ruins of your cities. Then you will be known as the people who rebuild their walls and cities. This is basically the text that Dwelling Places, the organisation Dwelling Places, is based upon. It's all about a hope and a light in a darkness, and rebuilding ruined lives, broken families, and giving these children a hope that they didn't have before. I'm speaking in three parts. So the first part is just going to be a quick overview of Dwelling Places. It's a Ugandan organisation. It's all staffed by Ugandans. Apart from volunteers who go out from time to time, either for anything up to 1 week to 1 year or longer. But it is a Ugandan-based organisation. It was started by a lady called Rita Nkemba, who felt very called, especially after reading Isaiah 58, to the plight of the children on the streets. Now, I'm not one for statistics, but there are many children, in the words of my children in school, pure hunters, of children on the streets of Kampala. And it's evident as you walk around, you will see them there. They'll be sitting from babies to teenagers. Their lives are on the streets. They've spent all their lives on the streets for various reasons. And Rita felt called to give these children a hope. So Dwelling Places works in four stages. The first stage is that they rescue the children from the streets. And the second stage is they rehabilitate them. So they take them into, we have a rehabilitation home. It's not an orphanage, it's just a trans rehabilitation home, TRH. There's a baby's house, a boy's house, and a girl's house, and we have some independent living quarters as well. So we take the children in, and they spend anything from 2 years to 5 years to 6 years or to 7 years. It's been a long process for some of these children to be rehabilitated into normal living. They have to be taught how to sleep in beds. They haven't slept in beds before. They have to be taught how to eat properly instead of just pushing and grabbing food when they can. They have to be taught how to take turns to wash and to go about. Part of the rehabilitation is also education, health, medical as well. So we work with these children. The third step is reconciliation. Many of these children have got family members somewhere out there. So we trace family members. We will go into villages or we'll go into the slums and we'll find these family members, and we work with the family members as well. We have income generating projects for some of the mamas, and it is mostly mamas that we work with. So they'll start making things or cooking things or selling things, and they start getting an income, and we also teach them how to look after their children. And then the final step is resettlement, when we firmly believe that the child is ready and the family is ready to receive the child back into the family. And that's the biggie. That's the final stage and the big stage. Obviously, we'll continue to support the child while they go home, and then slowly start to ease off. We have resettled some of our children this year and the year before, and I'm really pleased to say that many of them have been successes. The children have loved being back home. The vision of Dwelling Places is until every child has a chest to rest their head on and a place to call home. They won't stop. And that's, a child should be in a family, a child should be in a home. So I'm just going to show you a quick, it might not be so quick, Stuart thought it was the longest PowerPoint he'd ever seen. A PowerPoint just showing Dwelling Places and where these children come from and the work that Dwelling Places do, up or down. This little girl, she had been found in the streets begging for many, many years, and she's very sick. A team came over from Northern Ireland and they rebuilt or created from scratch a home for her and her family, and that was the end product for them, and the family are all living there now, which is great to see them. Obviously, we give love to the children in Dwelling Place. That's my mum. She came out to visit me, but I think she spent more time with the children. These are some of the girls coming back from a mainstream school that they are sent to. They love education. They love going to school, which is unusual. These are two little girls who we put on a production. They love to sing and dance, and part of the rebuilding is also a choir that they have to boost them. So they love performing at any given opportunity. This is our new dining hall, which we raised funds for, and this is the children sitting down. These are two kids on their way to church one Sunday morning, looking very smart. This is one of the classrooms in the school that they have. They love to put on their uniform, and this is just a little boy on a bike, playing, a broken bike, you have to say. We give them security for the first time in their life. They feel secure within the home. That's the dining hall, the building that had just been built in the girls' home, and one of the classrooms is just behind. Some of these are just cute pictures. And they live like a family, brothers and sisters, and they squabble as well. These children are not perfect children, but it's lovely to see the older teenagers. We have boys and girls up to the age of 18, and then older living in rented accommodation round by, and they really care for these younger ones. We give these children a hope for their future. This is the beds. Now, these blankets were donated from my home church. They had a fundraising night, and every child got a brand new blanket and a brand new towel, which they'd never had before, and jammies. So they're very excited about going to bathe now and use their towel and then put on their jammies, Pirates of the Caribbean jammies for some and Barbie ones for the rest, including the boys. But they don't care. This was bedtime one night. They were so excited. That's our babies, some of our babies from the baby's home. I think this says it all. She has a hope for the future. Now she's no longer on the streets. Of course, the future is to be back with their families. And I used to love spending time with the families. This is one of the families. And this man is the father. These are all his children. And we had five of these children. This is a family that my Sunday school supports, a little boy in the front carrying the baby. They've all been resettled and they're back home. And obviously, until every child has a chest to rest his head on, a place to call home. Some of our girls, they had formed their own mini choir. Take takes one person to offer one act of kindness to help a child in need. And this just doesn't just count in Africa, it's here also. Now, this part I'll talk about later, but it's just to get you thinking how you can get involved. Different ways. Become a child sponsor. This little girl's actually sponsored by my auntie, and she sent over a Scotland teddy bear, and she was very, very pleased with this teddy bear and wouldn't let anybody touch it, no other babies in the baby house. There's also just a monthly donation. £1 can buy 10 cups of milk. 50 pence can buy a balanced, nutritious meal. 20 pence can buy taxi fare for an HIV-positive mother to go to hospital. These are major, big projects that Dwelling Places has to become more self-sufficient, but obviously they need to start off. The upkeep for a cow had to be put in because on my final day, they had a party and the cow was actually slaughtered, which was very upsetting for me because I knew that cow very well. Anyway, it had a disease that we wouldn't contract if we ate the cow meat. And volunteer, obviously, these are different ways you can volunteer. And commit to pray, which I would probably say is the biggest. Prayer is just so important. And you might think that you're not doing very much by just praying, but praying is very important, and I'll share how prayer is so important. Together we can change Uganda by helping a child in need. I think that's the end of my slides. That meant to happen. It wasn't my first picture, but it doesn't matter. It's my last picture. We're going in reverse order. Okay. How did a wee girl from... I've got a sore throat. I don't usually sound like this. I think it's coming back to this weather and central heating, which I wasn't used to, and cold weather, which I also wasn't used to, and maybe possibly raising my voice at my children that I teach ever so infrequently. Okay, just from time to time. Anyway, how did I end up in Uganda? Because I am a Partick girl, born and brought up in Partick, lived in the city all my life, was definitely a city girl, liked my home comforts, and... I didn't ever begin to think that I would ever find myself in Africa. I always had a like for Africa, and I would say that their babies are very cute, little cute black babies. I always thought they were adorable, but I didn't think for a second that I would ever find myself there. My mum, we had Ugandan friends, and they had... do you know what, I'm going to... Can I get them all up and then can I go back again? Would that work? Oh, no. Oh. Okay. I have Ugandan friends, and one of them was getting married, and he invited us to the wedding, which was great. We were all going to go, but unfortunately he didn't get the 10 cows that he had to get as a bride price in time, so the wedding just kept on having to be postponed and postponed and postponed until it eventually turned out that I was back at work and couldn't go. His reasoning was that I was to say to my head teacher, my brother's getting married in Uganda, but I didn't think my head teacher would quite believe that he was my brother and would let me take the time off. So my mum set off with her friends, went to Uganda, was sending me texts like, oh, we've just seen a lion, and you know, all these texts that you don't want to be getting when you're stuck in Scotland and you really want to be there. And I was feeling quite sorry for myself, and my mum came back and started showing me the photographs, and I really felt in my heart, I really need to go here. I really need to go and see this country for myself and to experience some of the experiences my mum had had. So I asked her if she would be my tour guide for the following summer, and she agreed, and we set off. And I arrived there, and I didn't really quite know what to expect. Anyway, I visited Dwelling Places, and that was me, completely bowled over. Left my heart there with these children who have lived on the streets, who have been living on the streets, who have never had love before, have never had people caring for them, and yet they are the most affectionate, loving children, and appreciative of everything that they get, and it was just such a joy to be with them. So I spent most of my days in Dwelling Places, and hanging out with the children, cuddling the babies, and generally not being very much use, but having a great time. And I left there, and my world had been turned upside down. I came home, and felt very, very, very unsettled. Very unsettled, and had inside me this deep feeling that I was to go back to Uganda. However, my life had always kind of fallen into place, you know. I never had to go onto my knees and plead with God and ask him where I had to go next in my life. I'd never had to do that. Obviously, God was in control and was making my life just fall into place. But I went to university. I didn't have to move away from home. I could walk to university. I always wanted to be a teacher. Got into Jordan Hill, trained to be a teacher, got a job, everything. Got moved into my own flat, bought it, got a car. My life was great. It was great. And all of a sudden, my life that I thought was great was not great anymore. I didn't like it. I didn't want to be here. And I was really, had this real sense of just unsettled. I was just really unsettled and couldn't quite understand what was wrong. So for 1 year, I kind of battled with this. And then I went out the following summer on my own to back to Uganda, back to dwelling places. I lived in a cottage in the village on my own, just testing God. Testing God to see, right, God, is it me or is it my, is it me or is it you? Because I was feeling that it was my emotions and I was caught up with this and I wanted to go back for me. But if it was really God, then he had to show me that it was really God. And this was his part of his plan for me. Part of his plan for me was to go back to Uganda. So I went out and spent the first night terrified, out of my wits, living alone in this cottage and every bang and every clang. And I was convinced and I thought, you know, Lord, I don't think you've brought me all this way to be murdered on my first night. It wouldn't be much use to anyone, but maybe you have. And if this is your will, then so be it, because I was exhausted by this point. Anyway, I woke up the next morning, very thankfully, and went up to dwelling places. And that night, I walked down the road and I had a wonderful day. But still, you know, I was still thinking, is it me? You know, is it me? Or is it God? And I heard the children singing. I couldn't see them, but I heard them singing. I have decided to follow Jesus, really. And, you know, they sing with gusto. And they were singing and singing and singing. And I just stood rooted to the spot. And I heard them singing, and they continued singing. And no more turning back, no more turning back. I have decided to follow Jesus. And they sang the song. And they sang all the way until they got to me, and then threw their arms around me, Auntie Donna, and that was it. I just knew this was from God, and this is what he wanted from me. And it was quite hard to let go of my life and hand it over completely to God, which I suppose I shouldn't be saying that after being a Christian for many years, but I think we all like to kind of hold on to our life. And my prayers used to be, Lord, whatever it is you want for me, but, or see if you could, that would be great. And my prayers turn to whatever, Lord. It's my life is yours, and I am yours, and I'm what you want for me. And from the moment I realised that, I had this peace inside me. Even though I was seemingly giving up everything to go and live there, I just had this peace, and again, everything fell into place. So I arrived there last July 2007, ready to spend 1 year in Kampala, Uganda. This is a Kampala skyline. You can see it's very sprawling. Again, I'm not one for figures. There's pure hundreds of people that live in Kampala as well. And you can see some of the taller buildings. It's quite a big and bustly city. And I arrived there quite thinking, oh, well, I've been here before. It's okay. Well, it wasn't. It's Taxi Park. This is where I used to have to find my taxi to get home. Somewhere in amongst there is my taxi. It would generally be in the same kind of area, but not always. However, I love Taxi Park. You could buy anything in the Taxi Park. You can buy jewellery. You could buy food stuff. You can buy degrees from any university in the world. You can buy the most amazing sweets, shoes, underwear. You would see people trying on underwear. Taxi Park is the best place, and I felt so home in Taxi Park. It looks really intimidating, but I love Taxi Park. And it's mostly men. They have a conductor. I had to use public transport all the time. Taxis being one of the main ones. They have a driver and a conductor who shouts out the window and shouts where they're going. So it would be like party, 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 party very loudly, and tries to get customers to come on. So I made friends with quite a lot of the guys round about, so I would always find my taxi. They looked out for me. And of course, being white, Mzungu, you would get many calls of Mzungu, Mzungu, where to? And they would actually take you. If you said where you were going, if I was travelling anywhere else, they would actually take me to my taxi, which was great. And the men coming round selling, and you would call them over to your window, and because you have to, it won't go until the taxi is filled up. So that's Taxi Park, my second home. Many's an hour I spent in Taxi Park. This is a typical scene. There's a market just behind there, and this is a Boda Boda motorbike, also my most favourite type of transport, where you just jump on the back and sit like a lady sideways and keep your balance. There's a knack of get yourself on. And Boda Bodas take you absolutely anywhere. They're called Boda Bodas because they went from border to border. Boda Boda. And they're great. Boda Boda men are notorious for giving you a Mzungu price, white price, and bargaining a wee bag in, and you would have to go through all this. But I love my Boda Bodas. And when my mum came out, she even went on one. She didn't sit like a lady, though. That's one of the entrants into Taxi Park. You see the New York bag being sold outside, and bags, and basically anything just gets sold outside. Some more Boda Boda men. When they're not got fares, they sit about and hang about. Now, this walk, you can see the Caltex, and diagonally across from the Caltex is the new Taxi Park, which is where I used to get on and off my taxis. From there, I would then have to walk up through this area. This is a quiet day, by the way. And if you look very closely, you will see almost all modes of transport. Wheelbarrows, trucks, lorries. There's some cows sometimes at the top of the hill. I would get dropped off at New Taxi Park, and I would have to walk my way through this area to get up to Tarmac Road and shops and nice places, nicer places. I hated this walk. I hated it. I hated it because you would get hassled quite a lot. Being the only white face for most of the place, other people would take public transport, but quite a lot of the big missions organisations and other people would have their own vehicles and would never come down to this area. So you would get hassled, you would get shouted at, you would get many marriage proposals, which some people might think are nice, but it's not really, because they're not the most romantic ones. They would be shouting, you know, pawing at you, Mzungu, Mzungu, Mzungu. Yes, everybody, I am white, you know, and sometimes you would just get so frustrated, and sometimes you would feel a bit kind of, everyone pushes, and we're very polite, very ever so polite, you know, after you, you know, no, it's okay. My elbows had to be out, and I had to push and shove and duck and dive, and people would be running with like mattresses on their heads, and you would have to get out of the way, and they would shout out if you weren't quick enough, and it was really quite stressful. Unfortunately, I had to do this every time I went to town. And there was one particular day where Gaddafi, the man from Libya, and I shouldn't say man, Colonel Gaddafi, the president of Libya, was opening a huge, big, massive mosque that he'd commissioned not far up from there. So the whole place was actually shut down, roadblocks and soldiers, and I didn't realise, and I'd gone into town, and the taxi man said that he was going to have to let me off at this Owino market, which was not a place I should be getting let off as a white female. And I would say, no, you say, well, you can't, you need to take me on, no, you have to go off. So a girl kindly took me under her wing, and we started walking, and the next minute she was surrounded by all these army officers, and they had taken her away because she was wearing a camouflage top. So I was left on my own, and you know, I was walking through, and there was all these militia men, and it was very militant, and a lot of Muslims, and they were wearing their, like, these things, dishcloths, like, round their heads, and, like, grenades strapped to them, and, like, women, and you could only see their eyes. I was very, very scared, and I was sharing with Stuart last night. When I was younger, I used to have to learn the Psalms and catechisms, and it just came to me in my head, and I used to resent it when I was younger, but it came to my head, Lord, you've searched me, and you know me. You know my lying down, and you know my rising up. You know, God knew where I was right at that exact second. My mum didn't know. Nobody else in dwelling places knew where I was. Nobody else around about me knew who I was or what could happen to me. Yet I was so certain at that point, God, it's all right. God knows where I am. He knows when I'm lying down. He knows when I'm standing up. He knows where I'm going. He knows what's before me, and I'm okay. And, you know, I just, the whole time, I was just going over and over and over, this psalm in my head, this psalm in my head. However, I got through it and unscathed. Then I arrived at my, this is dwelling places, you can see a sign, white sign, Henrietta's Garden. Just behind that, there's a yellow sign, Chinyingi Drive. That was my drive up to my house. This is my main road, and that's my Boda main, just behind it. No tarmac, very, very muddy. My supermarket's just behind the bushes. It was a shed, selling some things and a bench outside. This was to be my patch for the next year. I also had to learn some of the language, especially how to greet, which can go on for quite some time. And I think I used to impress people when my Mzungu friends would visit, and I would be there greeting, and it goes on for quite some time, but I was only greeting, it wasn't going any further. That's me, my Boda men. I got to know them very well, and they looked out for me, they looked out for their aunties. And I travelled about at night, which I really shouldn't have been doing, but part of my work was to do work at night, homework club with the children. So my Bodhi men, I had all their phone numbers. In fact, I still do have them in my phone, all their phone numbers, and every night at 9:30 I would have to phone and say, can you come and pick me up? And they would say, oh, I'm very far, and then I would phone the next one, and oh, I can't, I'm in bed, and then I would have to phone the next one. So these are my Bodhi men. This was my home for the year. This was just when I first arrived, so it did get kind of a bit more jazzed up with things on the wall, but this was my wardrobe. That was it. That's where I lived. I had no toilet to begin with. There was a cottage where other volunteers lived, so I was allowed to use their facilities during the day, but they locked their door at night. So at night I had a hole in the ground, which was nice. A bit scary when it's pitch black outside. And I was on my own. This used to be the old chicken coop, actually, but they had managed to do it up. And there's our babies. So I went to Dwelling Places, finally got to Dwelling Places. This is bath time with the babies in the baby's home, and I just think they're so cute. Loving bath time. Oh, I love this picture. This was my classroom. Unfortunately, my classroom was also in the girls' home, so they would use it to dry. To dry items of their clothing, along beside my lovely handmade charts that I had spent many hours making. This is the kind of thing that you would find. I had a piece of chalk and a blackboard. That was it. That was me. That was my resources. That was what I had. And I taught, when I first arrived, I taught in a local school for 6 months, which was great because I really got to know everyone round about in the area and the children. And then in the afternoons, I would work for Dwelling Places and would go and visit children at school. I would bring them supplies to school. I would go to parents' nights. I would write up minutes for the education department. And I was generally quite busy in the afternoons doing more office stuff or travelling around. And then in the evenings, I would do preps. The second half of my year, we homeschooled some of our children. We took them out of mainstream school. They're in a choir and they love to sing and dance. The plan was to take them to the UK and kind of take them on tour. That has all fallen apart. It's just too much of a financial, a great expense for Dwelling Places that we really can't afford to do. Anyway, we had taken these children out, so I taught these children in the mornings, and then they had choir intensive rehearsals every afternoon. So this was one of my classrooms. Here's me hard at work. Very, very basic, but I loved it. It was great fun. Them very hard at work as well. They have end of term exams that they have to pass, and at the end of the year they have to pass their end of year exams. These are big things for these children, and if they don't pass at the end of the year, they have to repeat that class. So it's a big emphasis is put on them. And because we were keeping to the Ugandan curriculum, we had end of term exams, and this was one girl. In fact, many of them did this just before their exams, praying. Yeah, this is a family, one of the families that we've resettled, the boy in the yellow and the boy in the red. We'd resettled these two boys back with their mum, and I managed to go out and spend some time with them. They stay in a place near Jinja, which is where the source of the Nile is. So I had, this is just a newborn baby mum had as well, and they don't actually name their babies until they're about a year old because there's such a high infant mortality. So that's, we don't know the name of that baby, but they're loving being together as a family. And that's Jeffrey, the little boy at the front. My mum's Sunday school has been sponsoring for the last 5 years, and he's back with his mum and their family. Overall, I think, oh dear, now you've got an insight into the next song. We'll just... overall, my year was absolutely amazing. I left here with the words of Paul from 2 Timothy. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, and I've got to say it was only God who gave me strength to cope with so many things. From the smallest things like this glass of water that I've gone to visit family, they've given me a glass of water. I have to pray for protection from that water because I don't know how many parasites are in it or how clean it is. So you pray for protection, you drink it, you're safe. You have to praise God for keeping you safe. Two larger ones like travel. Myself and my mum were involved in an accident, and a lot of prayer went up in those moments. And again, we had to give thanks to God for protection and for keeping us safe. And it was just such an amazing way to live, and that's how these people live. They live every day bringing everything to God. everything to God, the smallest things, and then being able to thank God when these things happen. And it was just, it was so liberating to be able to, as a Christian, to be able to live that way as well, to be able to see God at work so evidently. And he is at work here, but we're somehow blinkered to what he's doing. Because, you know, there, if a mother is sick and everyone prays, that's our first port of call. We don't go to doctors, we don't rush to accident emergency, we pray. I'm not saying that's maybe what we should be doing. Maybe it is. They pray. And then when that person is healed, they give thanks to God because that person is healed. It's not, oh, well, the doctor gave me great tablets. That's a great doctor I have. Or when there's no food, which we don't, fortunately, and thankfully we don't have that, but when there's no food, they pray. And when food comes, they praise God. They don't say Sainsbury's is a great shop or that Marks and Spencer's have got great deals on just now. It's God who gets all the glory, and to be able to live like that is just fabulous. And also another thing for these children, we are giving them a hope because we're giving them a hope because we're giving them an education, we're loving them, we're feeding them, we're caring for their health. But also spiritually as well, we're giving them a hope. And we can say to them, do you know what? You might have been born in the streets. You might not know who your mum and dad is. You might not know how old you are. Imagine not having an identity. Our identity is where we were born, who we were born to, how old we are, the kind of person we are. They don't know that about themselves. They don't know that. They have no identity. They don't think they're worth anything. And they've been sitting there begging. People have been beating them as you go past, as they go past, as you saw in the footage. But to be able to say to these children, do you know what? While you were being formed in your mother's womb, God loved you. God cared for you. He knows who you are. He knows your name. They used to sing a wee song and do a dance. He knows my name. He knows my name. And to be able to say that to these children, and to be able to say not only that, but he has a plan for you. And it's a good plan. You know, you see them. They start, wow, you know, it's not just this person who loves me or that person who loves me. God, the creator, like we were singing, you know, Lord of all the earth. But yet he loves them. And we give them a hope that way as well, that no matter what happens to them in this earth, they have a hope that one day they'll be in heaven and there will be no more tears and there will be no sadness, no more sadness. Okay, I've spoken a little bit about how Jubilee Place has started and what it does. I've shared a little bit about what I was doing. Although I was there as a teacher, I was there from quite early in the morning. My days would start about 8 o'clock in the morning with devotions with all the staff, which was also just wonderful to be able to devote your day to God. And at that time, we would share prayer requests with each other, and then we would give testimonies as to what God had been doing. And it was just it was a very special time to all come together and focus our day. Then I would go to teach, and then in the afternoons I would spend doing my other education duties. And then probably one of my favourite times of the day would be when the children started coming home from school. I didn't say, but there's 505 children on the programme at Dwelling Places, which is a huge number that we are struggling to cope with. There are, when I first arrived, there was about 112 in the home, and it has been going down because we've been resettling children. As it stands, I think just now there's about 70, around about 70 children in the home, and many of them are at mainstream school. So about between 5 o'clock and 6 o'clock, I would go and sit outside and just receive the children as they came home from school, and they would greet me in Lugandan on their knees and tell me how their day had gone. And it was just lovely, you know, like just being a mum to them, and they could running home and tell me, like, auntie, I was beaten today, which quite often was the case. And then we would have to sit down, well, what did you do, and how are you going to not be beaten tomorrow, and that kind of thing. Or auntie, I passed my test, or just coming and telling me things that happened in school. And I would usually sit and chat with them, and I just loved these times. It was such a special time to be with the children. And then in the evenings they would have prayer time, which is something really, really special that I just, it was such a privilege to be able to share with them. They would all come together, and it would be led by one of the older teenagers, and they would all come. It was part of the rules, but there was no adults there rounding them up with a big stick, which they would use for punishment from time to time. Anyway, there was no one rounding them up, and they would all come together, and they would, the person would lead and would say, okay, what have you got to him? Any prayer requests that you have. So the children would share their prayer requests, whether it was things to do with school, things to do with their family that they'd heard, things to do with staff members that they knew that staff members were kind of hurting with, or things about the organisation. Then there would be a time of testimonies and sharing how God has answered prayers and things that they could praise. And then they would go into their singing, and these children just love to sing. Love to sing and dance, but especially when they're singing to God, they just love it. And I've got a little clip. It's not of their worship time. It's actually just of them on a Saturday. They would do a youth club, And it's actually an outreach. The Dwelling Places Children do an outreach to the children round about in the local community. So this is just a little clip of them singing with one of the leaders. And you'll see my mum. I've not got you dancing. It's okay, don't worry. They just sing with such feeling and such enthusiasm, and to spend time with them every night singing. And they never tire of repeating, you know. We sometimes sing a few things over and we kind of lose heart after the fourth time. They will keep going and just be as enthusiastic at the tenth time. It's amazing. It's great. It's also great for the people who are leading. You don't have to think of so many things to do because they just want to do the same thing over and over. There were many challenges while I was there. One of them, Dwelling Places, is obviously under quite a lot of attack because it's doing God's work, and when you're doing God's work, you're under attack. And one of them, we had really bad press, and in fact, we were told we had to get rid of some of our children. They're from an area, Karamoja, up in the northeast, a very forgotten area, which either has droughts or has severe droughts or severe flooding. And we had to get rid of our children. So many of the children you've seen in that video clip, we had to call down, and we had to tell them that we were having to hand them over to the government and the police, which was obviously a terrible time. It was probably the worst night of my life, to see these little faces of the police that had given them hope, the police that had given them a future, the police that had given them a security, was all of a sudden saying, "I'm sorry, we're going to have to let you go." And it was very, very difficult. Dwelling Places, of course, I'm thinking Western Way, I'm thinking we need to get this sorted, we need to speak to lawyers, we need to do this, we need to do this. And Dwelling Places' response was, we need to get onto our knees and pray. We need to look at ourselves and see, have we as an organisation fallen away from God? Are we still fully focused on God? So we had a time of 40 days of fasting and praying. Now, I couldn't fast in the heat. I tried and nearly, well, very close to fainting. But most of the children, we didn't make them do it. Most of the children wanted to do it. We'd have early morning prayers at 5 o'clock in the morning and at lunchtime and at night. And these, to see these children coming and praying and just rededicating ourselves before God and asking God for his will in our lives. And then we had an overnight of prayers at the final. And I'm really pleased to say God heard our cries, and we got many, many, many blessings. And eventually we were told we didn't have to send these children back. But it just really made me think about what's our attitude when we come to times of trouble, or when we come, you know, we want to fix things, we need to get things sorted, we need to do this, or we shake our fists. And, you know, they just came to their knees and they looked at themselves first and foremost as an organisation, as individuals and as the children. So that was quite a big challenge, but I learned so much from it. And we're still, Dwelling Places is still under some sort of attack. The press, not all that long ago, they had to have a big media day and invite all the journalists in and show the work that Dwelling Places is doing. But they have also received many blessings as well. Another great favourite thing of mine to do was to hang out with the families. I loved going to visit these families. I loved being invited into people's homes, which would happen all the time. You walk along the road and you're just invited in. And just being able to sit there, and okay, you might not be able to speak the same language, I could greet for a long time and that would be it. But just being able to sit in their homes and for them to be so willing to share the very little that they had with you as a stranger, was just a fabulous time. And to be able to be accepted, I think that was just what really got to me, that how much I was just accepted for who I was in their home. And it was quite a normal thing to do. And I loved going to visit the children that we'd resettled, to see them going from the children we had in our home to being back with their families. And some of these homes I would walk into and I would think, oh, this is awful, you know, why are these children living like this? But they're home and they're happy, and that's how homes are. They're not like our Western homes. They have got everything they need. They have their mum, or they have their dad, or they have a jaja, a granny looking after them. They're being loved. They're being sent to school. Dwelling Places pays for their fees. And I just love spending some time with these families. And they're so appreciative. And again, they're appreciative to God. Jeffrey's family had been resettled, and the house had been built for them by another family who had come over to volunteer. And for the first time, Jeffrey's mum and his whole family are living in a house. It's the first time they've ever owned or lived in a proper house, and all her family are back together. And although Mama Maureen's, she's HIV positive, we also pay for her taxi fare to go, and she gets free ARVs, drugs, which are really helping her. She's just been given a new lease of life, as has her older son. Unfortunately, she's lost two children to AIDS, but the rest of her children are all negative, and they're doing really well. And just visiting them in their home is just, it's just wonderful. It's just great to see them in their home and to spend time with them. How to get involved. The first thing I would say is probably is the most important thing, is to pray. And there were so many times when I was so conscious of people praying for me, and it's really made me think now that I've come back home, like, how can I pray more effectively? And I do believe when something comes to you, then you should be praying. And there was many times at Dwelling Places as a whole, we asked for people to pray, and we knew people were praying for us. These children pray for the donors, they pray for the supporters, they pray for their sponsors every single night in prayers. And my school had raised quite a lot of money for Dwelling Places and used to send it out. And to hear these children in Uganda, these former street children, praying for my children in Clydebank was just amazing. Like, who would ever have been able to have planned that? And they would pray for Linville Primary every night, and individuals, and they would pray, like, for my friends and my family. And prayer is such a huge thing. And there's more information to become involved and to get their prayer updates, monthly updates. Now, I did have some. I've left them in the car. I'll give them to Mana, the October one, and you can sign up to get prayer, just to know what to focus your prayer on. There are also, that's the 2000 Dwellers Club. They call that the 2000 Dwellers Club. Oh, no, they don't. That's Isaiah 61 Club, Praying Partners. The 2000 Dwellers Club is to commit to contribute once a month, and you saw what £1 can buy, what 50 pence can buy, what 20 pence can buy. £1 would buy the milk. 50 pence is a balanced, nutritious meal a day. 20 pence is to taxi fare for these mamas that we support to get to the clinic. And there are also we'd run a child sponsorship programme where you can decide to sponsor a child in four different categories. There is education, health, rent and food. You can choose to sponsor the child in all areas or in just one of these areas. It's £46 a month for all areas, and the others vary. These are very sticky. I'm really sorry. I don't know why they're so sticky. But there's more information about that up at the back. And I just pray. And also, I think sometimes we have missions as in Africa or as in, and I've really struggled since I've come back thinking, why am I back here in Glasgow? You know, there's so much that I can do in Uganda. I'm so much more of use over there, and I can be much more helpful, and I have a purpose in Uganda. But, you know, I've been constantly being reminded since I've come back that mission is right on our doorstep, and there are needy people all around, and we need to be able to give them a hope and give them a future as well. So I just want to have you thinking about that that tonight. And if there's any questions, we'll be singing then. Questions or questions just now? Questions when we finish the singing. Now, has anybody got any questions about Dwelling Places, about me, more about the work or anything? What did I eat? I ate everything in sight. I did very well for the Scottish cause and ate for Scotland. I think everyone had great ideas of me going over there and only drinking fruit juice, and no, didn't work. Matoke is their staple, green bananas, but they're not like our sweet bananas. So you peel them and have a very sticky hands after it, and they steam them or mash them, and they would have that with beans. So that would be lunch. However, matoke, although it grows everywhere, is very expensive. So for us in Dwelling Places, it was posho, which is corn flour. It's just corn flour that they add water to, and for breakfast they would make it with lots of water and not mingle it so hard. So it's like, looks like wallpaper paste. I loved it. I really enjoyed it. My mum didn't. Quite a lot of people, I think maybe it was an acquired taste, but you would put a wee bit of sugar in it and have that very runny, lumpy stuff as a cup of porridge. And then they would continue mingling it for the rest of the day until lunchtime, where it would be solid. You think you saw it in the picture, this solid mass, and they would just stick their plate in and get this big solid mass. And they would have salt in it this time, not sugar. And beans. And then at night, they would have the same posho and beans. And then the next day, porridge, posho beans. Porridge, posho beans, posho beans. So we didn't get matoke that every day. They never tired of it. They loved it. I didn't eat it every day. It wasn't too good for me to be eating it every day. There were supermarkets there, so I could get things like Rice Krispies. And I remember the first box of Rice Krispies we got. It was so exciting. So, yeah, but that would be, that's their staple, the posho, the corn flour and beans and banana. When we had some money, they would get that on a Sunday maybe. Yes, Christine.
You were using English.
Yes. English is actually the official language. There's 57 different languages in Uganda. just tribal different dialects and things. So English is actually what's taught in school. So if a person goes to school, then they'll know English. Now, not everybody gets to go to school because you have to pay school fees, but the majority of people would be able to communicate basically with you in English, and if they have been educated, then English is kind of their first language. I lived in amongst the tribe, the Baganda tribe, which is the largest tribe. So the Bagandas from Uganda speak Luganda, so I learned Lugandan. but some of the children would only speak to me in Lugandan. You know, they knew I could speak some of it, so they would just speak to me in Lugandan. So I would be sitting there going, you're talking about monkeys, you know, and we would have a great laugh. So I could probably understand a lot more than I could actually speak, but I suppose hard pushed, if I was in a situation, then I could find some words somewhere to get me out of. But if I was to go back for longer, I would definitely say it just made such a difference when you could call out a greeting, or you wouldn't call out. As a female, I would be on my knees greeting the males all around me, so, or older people, I would have to go onto my knees. So, but to be able to communicate with them in their language, they loved it. They loved it. You kind of had a step into relationship straight away. But English is the official language. Many reasons. The biggest is poverty, sheer desperation. As I said, quite a lot of them have got families, so the families put them onto the streets, either because they can't look after them or because they want them to go onto the streets to beg and to bring back money to them. So poverty, and I don't believe that these parents don't love their children. It's desperation. They literally don't have anything. They have, you know, a piece of corrugated iron against a mud wall, and that's their home. If the children can go out and beg, then get some money, or just get rid of some children. Another reason, HIV/AIDS is a huge, huge killer in sub-Saharan Africa. So many of them have been left with no hope, no home. Their mum might have died, or they've been gone living with a granny, and the granny's died, and whole families have just been wiped out, and these children have been left, and they run. War. In the north, there's been a war running in the north of Uganda. The Lord's Resistant Army has been coming into villages and abducting children and recruiting child soldiers, and so there's many children who've fled from that area in the north to come down onto the streets of Kampala, and also in Karamoja, just with the sheer devastation and the floods and the drought and the starvation. I mean, literally they are starving. They would come to the streets as well. Some have been born in the streets. One of the families, the children have been resettled, they're third generation street children. You know, they're just the grandparents and then their parents and then these children. Now they're in a home. They have their own home. But there's loads of reasons. But the main thing is poverty. It's poverty. No more questions. Well, have you got a question? Initially, yes, they're very suspicious when dwelling places first make the first contact. However, they soon realise that they will benefit from it as well, because there is the family empowerment programme. So if we say that we are taking a child, we usually take in the family. If there's a big family, we'll take in quite a lot of them. But if we say we're taking in their child, they've got to sign up to this family empowerment programme, which means that they get help, they get medical assistance. They're taught different things, different skills, and they will be given a kind of income generating project to start up and to run. So, and their children are their school fees are being paid for, and so initially yes, but then after a while they realise that it's going to benefit not just that one child that we've maybe met in the street, but the whole family and also themselves. And to go back into these slums, and we don't move them out of the slums, or there's only a couple of families, and that's because they came from the streets that we've rehoused. The rest of them, they stay in the slums, they stay where they are, but they might have like a restaurant, or I say restaurant, okay, it's a bench and a cooking pot beside it, but they might have that, or they might be selling cassava, or they might be selling charcoal, and they have this, and they're staying in their own community, and then their children are being looked after and then brought back to them, and so they do sign up pretty readily after that when they realise that everyone will benefit from it, and they've also got to agree to accept their children back and to keep them from the streets again. So, yeah. Yes. What, for like taking their child from them? No, we did have, when I was saying that we were getting like kind of bad press, what had happened, it was a few of our older. See, the problem is we take in children that are all ages. So we have had children that we'd maybe taken in when they were 16 or 17, and that was like 5 years ago. So now they're grown up and they're adult. And quite often when they get to that age, the lure of the street is really, the street can be an appealing place in certain kind of areas for them. Quite a lot of the children, you saw some of the boys there, they cook glue and they inhale glue, and you know, they're very sexually active from a very young age, all these children. So obviously when they come into dwelling places, we're kind of putting a stop to that. So the older children, we have more problems with the older children because, well, they're not getting money anymore, and they used to maybe steal, and they used to have money, and they could do whatever they wanted, and all of a sudden they've come in and there's rules and there's regulations, and then and deep down they know it's for the best, but they fight against it. They fight against it. So what we had was quite a few girls going back to the streets, or being a bit promiscuous with some of our older boys, and falling pregnant. And obviously we have to discipline them, and we've never put any of them out. But one of the girls, she kept on, she would continue being pregnant, and she had like a child, and then left the child with us, and she went away and had another child and brought the child back to us for us to look after. Well, she, so we eventually said no, and we started to come a wee bit tough with these girls, and that's, they've then kind of retaliated, and that's where our kind of bad press has started coming from. They blinked up and started saying, well, dwelling places didn't care for them. And but all our parents, I would say to a man, have stood up and said Dwelling Places is a great organisation, and if it wasn't for Dwelling Places, I would be here on the streets, or my child would be on the streets. So the parents we don't have any problems with, but we do have some problems with former children that we had in our care. We have quite a few total orphans. So what we do is we try and look for people to adopt them from within Uganda. And there was one little boy, Solomon, who I think myself and my mum both definitely fell in love with when we first arrived. He was a very small, fat boy who wore pink flowery dungarees with big bows and pink shoes. And it was just so cute. He didn't choose to put them on. He was being dressed in this pink leggings and things, but he was such a character. And he was just, and he was a total orphan. And he's actually been adopted by a Ugandan couple, and he's to see him living in a home. We don't have that much contact with him, but you know, the social workers go out to see and make sure that everything's okay, and they actually came back and adopted another child. So it's great to see these children. So we do look for adoptive parents. Also, the staff members have got children, will take children in as well, to kind of as a step. Take them out of the home. If they've been in the home for a long time, the staff members will look after it. And there is one international adoption in the process just now with one of our kids.
You mentioned great volunteers for between a week and a year. Put me out for a shorter period of time, a week or two, what kinds of things can we usually do?
Okay, first thing, cuddle the babies. Babies' home's there, with many babies wanting picked up and cuddled. And as you can imagine, the mama who's in charge of the babies doesn't have much time to cuddle, and has got lots of cleaning to do. And so these babies, the second you walk in, they're just onto you. And some people might say, oh, going out and cuddling babies, but that is of huge benefit to these kids to have that interaction, which is what my mum became very good at, cuddling the babies. She was a real expert, and the older ones as well. There's the education department, which anything to assist in the education department, whether it's teaching, whether it's assisting in the office. Just now we had quite a lot of volunteers out over the summer who actually went into admin work, into the office work. And I think most people think, oh, I'm going to Africa, I'm going to cuddle babies. But actually going into the office and sharing your skills and talents we got so many great, amazing things done. These leaflets, like anything you see like that, there's a great website that's been set up again. A volunteer has come in and done that filing. You know, even if it's just filing, my mum would file some days as well, just to help in that. There's a spiritual welfare side of things as well, and doing the outreach They've got outreach into the slums. There's meeting with the parents and just doing different things with that, coming alongside the people. there's health. We have a health two people in our health team. So just even assisting them. We had a lady who was 63 who came from Canada to spend Christmas and New Year in dwelling places. She'd been a nurse, a hand nurse for 38 years, and she had come out. Because the nurse from dwelling places had gone home. He's from Kenya, had gone home. So she came and basically, you know, at night she would go up and make sure that every child was okay. She would give out some paracetamol. In fact, it ended up she had a really busier time. We had some kids in hospital and things. But, I mean, anything. Also, we've had teams that have come out as a full team and built something, you know, come out with money and had built part of the dwelling places or homes for people. Digging fields, making a kraal for the cow to live in, weeding, sports, huge sports, with boys that were over from Ireland and they would come and do sports with the children. I mean, the list goes on and anything that you might not even recognise in yourself. And I think that's another thing as well, when you go to Uganda or when you go, especially in dwelling places, you go and you might say, well, I definitely can't do that. And you know, it's amazing how maybe sometimes you can actually do it, and it's just what God has for you at the time, and it might be not what you really want, but it's definitely it can be used. I don't actually think so. I honestly don't. Two pairs of hands, in fact, one pair. It doesn't matter. If you can get into Uganda, you're going to be of use and of benefit, and you see these children, and I think that's another thing as well. We sometimes think, oh, well, I'll go and help, you know, I will. Do you know what? The blessings that you receive are 10 times more than you could ever imagine. And it's just so, it's such a privilege. It's a privilege to be even allowed that opportunity to be with these children and to be blessed by these children. I just remembered it. Okay. This is did you not see that? Well, good question. Yes, I did, in answer to that. This is just a wee PowerPoint, and it's just, I love it so much. I love the words of this song. They're just so meaningful, and I just love these faces. And when you see these faces up there, these faces to me are wee people, and I've cried with these kids, and I've laughed with these kids, and I've hugged these kids, and I've scolded these kids, and I just love them so much, and I just think this, to see these wee faces and this song especially, I love it.